Good morning. You guys look rain-soaked. This is what I thought you'd look like coming into, this is what a Californian thinks. Yeah, Forza, thank you for having me out. Thanks to your good Archbishop Sample. Thank you for coming out in the rain. And those of you who watch TNT for a year, thanks for doing so. I appreciate all the support, all the love I've gotten. I've gotten a lot of hate in the past year on Twitter because, as my friend Jesse Romero and I talk about all the time, there's a real battle. You come to conferences like this, Catholic men's conferences, which I've started to do, and hear a message like mine. And it's surprising to me the degree to which the crisis through which we're living, which is in no uncertain terms the greatest crisis in the history of the world, the expedience, the supposed heal, the greatest crisis in the history of the world, are weak, right? Weak medicine, tepid, and premise buying. So be prepared in the course of my two talks, which both address different facets of the battle, to hear, I guess, shocking premises. I mean, this is the greatest time, let me put it this way, in the history of the world for men, the leaders of the world, leaders of the family, leaders of the church. There's an ecclesiastical patriarchy that is called, the patriarchy, by the way, is the Roman Catholic Church. I'm going to talk about that next. And there is a familial cultural patriarchy, and that's known as the family. Cardinal Carlo Caffara, one of the best leaders on planet Earth, who died a little over a year ago, had corresponded with Sister Lucy of Fatima, the surviving seer of Fatima, and she had told him in a private correspondence in 1991 that this is the greatest crisis that the world has ever faced, and that the final attack, note the eschatological language involved in this, the final attack of the devil would be on the family, meaning homo stuff, meaning divorce, the regularization, normalization of divorce, meaning transsexualism, all the filth that we see. And more than any of this, the original transgender, the great evil, the cancerous tumor lesion on the heart of, on the beating heart of Holy Mother Church, and the canker on the heart of the laity, which is feminism. Vile, wicked feminism. We're going to talk about this the second talk. So I want to get people psyched out. And we're in Portland, people. Like, this is what I want you guys to do is be ready to fight. This is all second talk stuff, but there's a connection between modernism, right? Modernism, you're not told effectively what it is. You know, most of our bishops and most of our holy fathers have essentially abandoned us. We're all parish orphans. Most of us weren't, I mean, some of you might have been. You have the good fortune of having been raised by fathers that taught you what you need to know. You're in the few. And I don't just mean, you know, 50% of people, this is what I tell my high school students, 50% of people in America come from broken homes, right? Or whatever the number is year to year. It's always around 1 in 2, even odds. Well, among those 50% of ostensible Catholics that ostensibly live in the heart of the faith, it makes you want to laugh, right? This isn't how people in the cities are living. We're in Portland. It's practice. No. We're in Portland. Sorry, I'm channeling Allen Iverson here for some reason this morning. But We're not in the suburbs, not in the cities. People don't live in the heart of the faith. I mean, most people. Now, a lot of you good people, a lot of you good men are soldiers, and you're actually doing this. But this is a group within a group. This is the cream on top. What percentage of that? Those 50% that are lucky enough to live in the same under the same roof as their fathers are being instructed in the faith by the priest of the ecclesiola. Not 50% of 50. Would that it were that high, my friends. It's such a small portion. None of my friends with whom I attended Dallas Jesuit even practiced the faith anymore. No one that I went to grade school with at St. Mark's of Plano or St. Francis in Bakersfield, like none of them practiced the faith. You think that's a coincidence? No, when fathers don't teach, the faith don't preach. So the first half of this is modernism. Listen to me. When you're writing a book, this is your life. And I've been writing two books for the last year and a half. So I want to talk about feminism because I'm more excited about this and I want to fight. I mean, it's the time for a fight. That's what time it is. And I know you're not used to hearing that from the secular world. Catholic light world, even the trad Catholic world, you're not used to hearing that, but that's all there is left. That's what there is for us. We'll talk about the terms there when we get to precisely what feminism is. First, you have to understand what modernism is, and lots of good, faithful Catholics, they talk about it without defining terms. Modernism has two halves. What are the two halves of modernism? It's got to do something with the modern world, right? Or else it'd be a pretty stupid term. In the 16th century, we had the arch-heretic, Martin Luther, and all of his protégés and detractors, and, you know, there's something called diversionary evolutionary biology, where two things happened. A lot was happening in Northern Europe and the Northeast that was culminated from the same forces that produced a Martin Luther, right? So they weren't all copycats. John Calvin, you know, Zwingli, all those guys, even Hus, the proto-reformers. These were the original modernists. So when you hear churchmen, good churchmen in our faith, I'm talking men like Cardinal Caffara, who said that the final attack would be on the family. I'll resume that after the break when we talk about feminism proper. And by the way, you can tell what that probably means about our time. I mean, no one can read the sign of the times perfectly, but we want to be able to do it approximately. But modernism proper begins with Protestantism. Do you realize that? And look, here's all it is. It's an attack on the natural law. It's got three prongs. This all plays out in America in a uniquely provident way. And so we all have normalcy bias. Like what? Really our home country, our fatherland happens to be the place where this is all playing out. And Russia, America and Russia, as you ought to know, all of you, I hope you study at least the basic skeletal facts of the Fatima prophecies. You know, the three parts of the secret. America and Russia matter. So why does America matter, this Protestant-founded country? Lots of people think it was a Masonically-founded country. Well, here's why. Here's why. Bear with me. If you haven't read my book, Catholic Republic, this is all just, I'm just giving you the skeletal outline. But it's very, very important because we're going to bring the fight in America first because we're the rebels. We're Johnny Reb to the world. That's what it is, even though it's ostensibly a Protestant place. So here's the argument. That's the first half of modernism. The second half came about a century and a half later with the Enlightenment, which most, you know, good churchmen, knowledgeable, faithful churchmen say, well, what was the Enlightenment? That's more properly speaking what people associate with modernism. Right, the demystification of religion, the revolution in Tierra and Cope, what the Enlightenment sought to do, particularly in places like France, the Freemasons that overtook the Jacobinist clubs in the 5, 6, 7 decades in the run up to 1789. It was all just Freemasonry. It was the demystification of the one true faith. We always have the bullseye on our back as Roman Catholics because all the other faiths are, you know, fake in one regard or another. So the one true faith, I'm just telling you the truth. I mean, I know that's not exactly what you're used to hearing, ecumenia, but men want answers. There's some stuff that's speculative, that's beyond our vision. This is not it. This we know. This much we know, so might as well not mince words. So the Enlightenment meant a hostility to the supernatural law of the one true faith, Roman Catholicism. That's what the revolution in Tiara was. And the revolution in Cope was getting rid of all forms of monarchy, theoretically the best form of government for Aristotle and Thomas, right? You have three acceptable regimes, monarchy, aristocracy, and republics. The best works out the least often, so you kind of hedge your bets according to Aristotle and Thomas. Okay, so republics are a viable form of Thomistic government. A lot of trads, my trad detractors and friends, get that wrong online. They say, oh, it's got to be a monarchy. No, America works because it's one of the three. It worked, sorry, because it's one of the three acceptable regimes. Okay, so we're straight from the jump. Revolution and Tiara and Cope, a lot of this stuff came from France, but it came from the Enlightenment. Reformation and Enlightenment, in my book I call it Prot-Enlight, just a dash. This is what modernism is. The Protestant Reformation rejected the supernatural law of the church. It attempted to be Christian while being outside of the church. There's no such thing as that, right? This is the third era, the era of the Holy Spirit. The Reformation rejected the supernatural law. The Enlightenment rejected the supernatural law a century later. The Reformation rejected the three prongs of the natural law. The Enlightenment rejects the three prongs of the natural law a century and a half later. Reformation, learn to view it this way, is just the early Enlightenment. Okay, what are the three prongs of the natural law? This is where America enters the scene and makes a difference. The founders called the kind of lack of care that the crown and parliament had for us from across the pond salutary neglect, right? You know, it was kind of good that they left us be because it let us have a revolution and, you know, ultimately decolonialize ourselves. But except it was also bad because we were being ignored. So the three prongs of the natural law are the proper view of nature, and what I was saying is, we were all told in middle school, 6th, 7th grade civics, that there was something called a Protestant natural law. And it played out here in America with a group of American revolutionaries like Jefferson and Adams who called themselves the Neo-Whigs, after Whigs in England from the previous century like John Locke and Algernon Sidney. These guys were John Locke and Algernon Sidney were the political theorists who were pro-parliament, were anti-king, they're for limited government. They got a lot of stuff right. That's why America is a crypto-Catholic nation. It's not a Catholic nation. We'll talk about why they got so much right in 1 minute. But the Whigs and Whig philosophy in 17th century England was the ultimate Prot-Enlight mashup, Protestant and Enlightenment. It claimed to affirm the natural law. Well, at the same time, it was Protestant and Enlightenment in its inception. Okay, we'll deal with that in a second, and why America is schizophrenic with regard to the natural law because of Protestantism and Enlightenment thought. First prong of the natural law: the view of nature as free and moral. Okay, look. In each of these three prongs of the natural law, I will prove to you why both halves of modernism, the Protestant half and the Enlightenment half, cannot dispense this prong, prong one, prong two, prong three. I'll prove it to you here today. I just need a whiteboard. I'm going to do it's like a page-long equation. No, I'm not going to do that. But I will prove it to you. It's quite simple. So if the view of nature as a place of moral freedom is the first prong of natural law, which it is, according to Aristotle and Thomas, and this cross-pollinates our politics, well then, okay, Protestants, who are really the grandfathers of what we would call the religious right here in America, Protestants don't view nature as a place of moral freedom, do they? I mean, literally, there's a text by Martin Luther. It was a debate text that he did, an extended debate with Erasmus, called The Bondage of the Will, right? The two parts of the human soul are will and intellect. If you believe that the human will is in bondage, you don't believe in prong one of the natural law, right? That nature is a place of moral freedom. Man is not free. John Calvin had a similar doctrine, right? It was called total depravity. Protestants, even though we kind of doff the cap as the progenitors of the modern American Republic, this is a problem. They're the progenitors of what's schizophrenic in the American Republic. The American Republic is crypto-Catholic because prong one can't be Protestant. Similarly, by the way, it can't be a corollary of the Enlightenment, the idea that nature is morally free. Why not? Because the Enlightenment taught something called corpuscularianism, determinism. There's no such thing as man's moral freedom. Listen to Richard Dawkins. I'm debating Richard Carrier in L.A. in a couple weeks. They say man is a glorified, more complex version of an animal, just a walking meat machine that acts only as to befit, to satisfy, to adequate our urges and our appetites, right? That's what they say. If you go to the zoo and you slip and you fall into the lion cage, the lion's not free, right? The lion acts such as to adequate its urges or whatever at any time. So you are SOL, you're out of luck if the lion was fed last night. That's your whole fate hangs in the balance because lions are not free. Prong one of the natural law. If it was fed an hour ago this morning, you're in luck. You live. A human being is not that way, right? We have choice. Intellect and will in conjunction. Aristotle teaches us how the intellect ought to lead the will. It conditions the will through habit. You select the golden mean between relative extreme and relative extreme deficiency on one end and excess on the other. That's our ethics. So that's prong one. The Protestants reject it because of, you know, man's will is inherently deficient, inherently bounded. Enlightenment thinkers reject prong one because they say that we're meat machines. There's no such thing. That freedom is an illusion. The Catholic Church alone is the only form, and the Orthodox, though they don't have as elegant an articulation, but the churches, Church East, Church West, are the only worldview in the history of the world that can articulate prong one of the natural law. Even Aristotle, who's sort of a proto-natural law thinker, he got all this right. He didn't have recourse to the Catholic Church. He's just sort of prefiguring the arguments. Prong two, you're a natural law thinker if you believe that, and this is really important, it all kind of unfolds in a way where America can be shown, just as manliness, true manliness, can be shown to have a unique role in the crisis facing the church, which is all but in a state of silent apostasy, and the world, which always groans out for the guidance and the patrimony of the church. Prong two is that nature is an intelligible place. Man is intelligent, you know, mankind. Nature alone is intelligible. This means meaningful. This stems from formal causation, one of Aristotle's four causes. So the Protestants reject the idea that nature is intelligible because they follow a doctrine called sola scriptura. This means only scripture is ultimately theologically intelligible. It's the only thing you can really count on or you can know about. But we as Catholics, as Aristotomists in our philosophy, we believe that you can learn from and about your surroundings. That's why the Catholic Church isn't afraid of good science and good philosophy. That's why all of the 39,000 denominations of Protestant congregations, our brothers in Christ, are. That's why they're afraid of science. That's why they're afraid of philosophy. I mean, it's literally that. It's just nothing. Don't believe any of these other things are going to lie to you. Truth really can contradict truth, contrary to what Thomas Aquinas taught. Truth can't contradict truth. Scientific truth won't contradict philosophical truth. It won't, neither of those two, contradict theological truth. Because nature is a place of intelligibility. Second prong of the natural law. Of course, the Enlightenment, on the other hand, it rejects the idea of natural intelligibility because, as Francis Bacon, one of the earliest Enlightenment thinkers, said, there is no two of the four Aristotelian causes, formal cause and final cause. Things don't have true essences. They don't have real meanings, right? You create your own meaning. Make yourself. Make your meaning. Make your life great. They believe that it's not a pre-existing thing, meaning, Platonic form, essence in the world. Which is why, you know, all atheists follow the Enlightenment and they say there is no meaning. Well, there is not if there's not created meaning. So both Protestantism and the Enlightenment reject prong two, that nature is, also it means they do bad science, both Protestantism and the Enlightenment. Contrary to what you're lied about in grade school curriculum, the Catholic Church is the only one, because of its Aristotelianism, that's capable of doing good science. That's why we were the ones behind quantum theory in the 20th century. We're the ones behind Big Bang Theory math, which Joseph Stalin said both Big Bang Theory and quantum mechanics proved the Catholic Church correct, which is why he put his scientists to death for even mentioning them. Because science and good philosophy prove Roman Catholic theology correct. Because we're not modernist. We're neither Protestant on the kind of right wing, nor are we, Protestant on the right wing, nor in post-Enlightenment secular humanists on the left wing. So those are the grandparents. The Reformation, here in America, we're these Catholics, right? We're between these two sides that are always yelling at each other. We like the Protestants more, but they're wrong about so much. Two halves of modernism. The grandparents of the right wing are the Protestant reformers. The grandparents of the left wing here in America are the Enlightenment thinkers. And they're much closer than even they know, the grandkids who are squabbling. Okay, and the third prong that both sides reject of the natural law is nature as goal-driven. The Protestants almost agree here. They believe Jesus, social reign of Christ the King, Jesus is the omega, right? They kind of get this right, but his connection to the world is attenuated. So they still get kind of an X here, half an X, half a check. And then as every intelligent design versus an atheist argument goes on the secular left, they reject the goal of the universe. Well, it wasn't created. I mean, there's a problem for, this is why Big Bang threw Einstein into a tizzy. He said, I can't be an atheist anymore. Because if there's a creation, there has to be a creator. If there's a creator, then there's something called a telos, a goal of the creation. Third law, third prong of the natural law. But if it's rejected by both the modernists, where in the world do we get Whigs from, like John Locke? Where do they get off saying natural law, right? The Declaration of Independence is the most important natural law document in the history of the world. This is actually true. But most of these ideas, here's where we come to it. John Locke and Algernon Sidney were responding to a British absolutist, very famous in his own day, named Robert Filmer. He wrote, in defense of the Tory kings in English politics, leading to the Glorious Revolution, a book called Patriarcha, one of the most famous texts in the history of the world, defending a new theory that the Protestants in England had made up called the divine right of kings. Guess who Robert Filmer is. And the Whigs, John Locke and Algernon Sidney, were going to take after Filmer. They hated him, you know, because they wanted to make this parliamentarian argument for natural law and natural rights. And they were right. Well, guess who Robert Filmer was responding to in Patriarcha? Robert Cardinal Bellarmine, who had first posed these ideas about republics, about the natural law, about natural rights, about subsidiarity, about virtue ethics in the populace, about church-state relations, about the family economy, about everything that would make a good republic function. Bellarmine, who was a Thomist, who was an Aristotelian. So Bellarmine set out the argument. Robert Filmer and the absolutists defending the crown argued against him. And the English Whigs, like John Locke, took up the rallying cry of Bellarmine. Fast forward about 80 years. The neo-Whigs in America, who you and I and everyone for 12, 13 generations in America have been brainwashed. Oh, we're reading, when we read the ideas of America, the ideas of the Declaration, we're reading English, Protestant, sort of Enlightenment-influenced ideas. Nonsense. It's nonsense. America, in its because of the Catholic intellectual tradition of Bellarmine and Thomas Aquinas and some of the early good Jesuits like Francisco Suarez, who actually went to the Greg. I was always excited that Suarez had been one of the first students at the Greg when I went there in Rome. These guys were the ones that posited true natural law. They embraced the three prongs of what true natural law is. Nature is moral and free. Nature is intelligible. Nature is goal-driven. Guys like Locke and Sidney and Jefferson and Adams, they're all some shade of Prodenlight. Guys like Jefferson were more Enlightenment-leaning. Most of the founders were more Protestant-leaning, but they are mostly a mix. And I just showed you the three prongs of the natural law were root and branch rejected by Protestants and Enlightenment secularists. This means that America, the leader of the free world, intended by providence to be so, by the way, if you take Sister Lucy and the Third Secret seriously, is actually, it's crypto-Catholic, it's hidden Catholic, it's arcane Catholic, in its intellectual makeup. Now, I know all of the responses, I know all the rejections, I know all of the repudiations of my theory, because this is an old book. Before Sophia Press picked it up for a second edition, it was picked up by Milo Yiannopoulos. He's actually the first guy that published it because he likes ideas like this. The church is right about everything was a talk he used to give. Whatever you think about the guy's troubled private life, he believes in his heart the church is right about everything, and he believes America's good. So he had the intuition, well, must be Catholic then. He was looking for a book like mine when it came along. So that's the point, is we have a schizophrenia as an American people. The Russians have a different kind of schizophrenia, right? They're religious in their spirit and they're orthodox. So they're a little closer to the truth. They're the eastern lung of the church in disunion. But we think we're... So what I say, the opening line of my book is, America is the nation wired Catholic, labeled Protestant, because of the schizophrenia I just spent 30 minutes laying out, and currently functioning secular. It's currently functioning secular because all of Protestantism is built, and the Protestants are great at the culture wars, and I have as many Protestant friends as Catholic, almost. But Protestantism is planned obsolescence. Do you realize that? Are you trying to hardwire a project that is Christian but outside the church? This is perverse. To reject the very notion of ecclesial structure, right? Bishops. We're Christian, but we want bishops. We don't want priests. We don't want sacraments. This is the practice of the faith. This is how it works. After you say those three rejections, what else must break down? both vocations there too. The lay vocation, which is having lots of babies and getting them to heaven and getting your wife to heaven because you're in charge. Or if you go the ordained route, the way of the cloth, to be the one to stand in front of them on Sundays and other days and to confer the sacrament, the one true path to heaven. That's it. So all of that breaks down. Martin Luther said, priesthood of all believers, meaning really no one's a priest. If you say everyone's a priest, you mean no one's a priest, right? No one's ordained, which is what he meant. He also said, quote, marriage is just a worldly thing. It's not a vocation. What's a vocation? A path to heaven. There are two vocations, right? I know some of the recent popes have talked about four, but vocations must be sacramental to be the kind I'm talking about, to be a real means of grace. You're either a father, capital F, or a father, lowercase f, and I keep running afoul of my later talk, but it's because I'm so eager to get to it. But I'm trying to situate the historical situation. America, which has this incredibly idiosyncratic, ostensible role in world history, because, oh, it's Protestant. Yes, it is. It's labeled Protestant. The people are Protestant. The skin is Protestant, but the heart is Catholic. And that is not just a bridge too far, a stretch by a goodwill churchman like myself. It's not what it is. Read my book, Catholic Republic. The arguments are all there. Literally, Algernon Sidney, more important than John Locke to Thomas Jefferson, he said it. More important to the Declaration than even John Locke was Algernon Sidney, another English Whig. He was accused during his life of plagiarizing Cardinal Bellarmine. So here's how something works when you're writing a book. It becomes your life. You're obsessed with it. At dinner parties or after dinner parties or not dinner parties, anytime you're around your friends, you're trying to steer the conversation toward your book, and everyone hates you. And it's the worst for everyone around you, except you. You're just like, yeah, it's cool. Yeah, the Lakers have only lost three games so far. That's interesting. But did you know Algernon Sidney was actually no, because Algernon Sidney is a fraud and LeBron James is a fraud. But that's fine. So wait, I hate LeBron James. I'm a lifelong Laker fan. Not anymore. I was until LeBron came to the Lakers. By the way, but. Guy's a fraud. Most overrated history in the athlete. Were any of you guys disappointed, by the way, to be missing the AJ Ruiz rematch today? Anthony Joshua Ruiz? Yeah. Yeah. 1 p.m. It's in Saudi Arabia, you know? Why do that? It's in Saudi Arabia, besides Anthony Joshua and Andy Ruiz. I'll conclude by saying this. So all republics go through three phases, necessary phases, insofar as they're republics, one of the acceptable regimes of government. And I'm talking especially about America now. There's three phases. It's really simple. Breaking the old regime, because there's no more land on planet Earth. You must break the old regime. Secondly, you must make the new regime. Thirdly, you must stake the new regime. If it's a republic, based on the natural law, you must stake that regime by the leaders into the heart of the people, and they must buy it. There must be buy-in. That's what we call ratification in the Senate, you know? I've spoken to you for about 42 minutes about, the first 12 minutes was about my feminism talk, but the last 30 minutes, I've talked to you about republics because we live in the most important republic of our time, and pretty much all of the modern times. And when I say important, I don't really care about world politics at all. I mean eschatologically. America, and I guess Russia as well, have a key role. We don't know exactly what it is, but in the fate of the world. And when I say the fate of the world, again, I don't really mean medicine or technology or iPhones or whatever. Who cares? Who cares? Men have become boring. I don't want to talk about those things. I'm talking about what matters. the Novissimi, the four last things, death, judgment, heaven, hell. That's where America gets interesting, right? That's where my book, which is about some not so much politics as political philosophy, showing people that the, you know, they thought they were rooting for the Los Angeles Lakers and their Celtics clad in gold and purple. This is the most facially anti-Catholic republic. It's kind of hilarious. Founded in the face of the world, right? They thought they were founding it because they're the Puritans that thought the Anglican Church was too Catholic. And it's and they had to recur because they wanted to do, because they're pretty smart, our founders. They're very smart guys. Something was in the water. They knew they had to plagiarize from Roman Catholic anthropology, which is philosophy of man, Roman Catholic ethics, which is what informs the polity, and therefore Roman Catholic political philosophy. I mean, I proved to you, you can't do natural law politics, which is what you need in a republic. When you're breaking that old regime, 1776, you can't do that from a Protestant or an Enlightenment perspective because they reject the natural law. They reject the natural law, rather. The second phase is making the new regime. It's a constitution. The beating heart or a constitution is an old Catholic concept. It was made into a term, subsidiarity, in the 1931 encyclical Quadragesimo Anno. But it's an old concept. It goes back through Thomas, goes back even before Jesus to Aristotle. It means government only locally. No tyrant from 3,000 miles away can tell me what to do, right? Just go ask Georgia. Subsidiarity. Go ask those three southern states that say Roe jurisprudence says we're not allowed to make an anti-abortion law. Okay, deal with this, right? That's subsidiarity. And that is the beating heart of the American Constitution. So let me conclude by saying this. The American regime was good for about 100 years, its first 100 years, right? When states had all the power. And I'm not saying perfect, but I mean good, which is why Pius IX sent Jefferson Davis according to some stories, he sent him a crown of thorns. But when he lost the Civil War, Jefferson Davis was sent by Pius IX a letter of condolence. Said, slavery is not good, blah, 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 we all know that. But states' rights, this is the one true way to do a Catholic republic. I mean, Jefferson Davis wasn't a Catholic, so he's like, whatever. But this is the one true way to do a republic. This is it. It's subsidiarity. Go look it up. Pius IX sent him, some people say, a crown of thorns, which is kingly gift. Social reign of Christ the King does not require a political monarchy, can work under one. A republic can work. And if a republic is to work, states' rights are key. The 10th Amendment. It's the only way to go. The late, great Justice Antonin Scalia called the 50 several states the fora of experimentation, meaning that's fine. If you want to, you know, if the sovereign people of the state of Massachusetts want abortion on demand, that's their problem. They can work it out with their creator at the end of their lives. But here in X, Jeffersonia, you know, the fifth theoretical state in the Union, no, we don't have that. Supremacy has to be there for the people. This is a very Catholic principle. It's subsidiarity. And ultimately, there's one solution. I'll leave you with this thought. Sorry. I mean, I should probably have unpacked it better. But ultimately, there's only one solution to the... We're talking about the, you know, the real worldly crisis in the history of the world when we talk about feminism, right? The original sin is feminism. Adam and Eve. Just gender swapping, role swapping, pretending girls are boys and boys are girls. Much more important than trans whatevers. But the point is, that's the world's issue. America, we have our own issues. We have our own crisis. And it's the idea that subsidiarity has been inverted, right? We're told what to do from 3,000 miles away. This is un-Catholic. It's immoral. It's vile, and we have things like abortion forced on us from basically a foreign tyrant. So it's 3,000 miles away from here to Washington, D.C., just as about a little more than 3,000 miles away from D.C. to London. We need a 1776. I don't know how you do this. But what you need, and I'm going to talk about manhood, and really what the patriarchy is in the proper ecclesiastical sense in the next talk. I mean, come on. I want to challenge you here today. I wasn't just joking when I was talking about AJ trying to get back his 3 belts from Ruiz in a couple hours here. 2 hours. In Saudi Arabia. Weird place to get your belts back. But I want to challenge you. Most of these men here have taught your sons. You're like the minority, the group within a group that probably have actually taught your sons, which is the main part of your vocation. Taught your sons. So boring. So Protestant. So Puritan talking about your job. Who cares? Honestly, you go to a dinner party, you don't want to hear about someone's job. Or their book. Fair enough. Don't want to hear about any of this. But what are the things that really matter? Death, judgment, heaven, hell, the novissimi. And so few, even ostensibly Catholic, undivorced fathers teach their sons about the sacraments or the sacramentals. They see their mother pray, most of them, you know, or their mothers take them to church. And that makes them, men don't take things that women do very seriously. And that's biology, right? This is Pew Research. They've done this study. I'm prepping up the talk now, not jumping into it. I have to keep giving a disclaimer. When men see their fathers do something, they do it. 89 or 90% of families that have one parent who's the father practicing the faith, 89 or 90% of those kids go on and practice the faith. If it's just one parent and it's the mother, it's like, wait, I was just talking about this back there. It's like a fraction of that, like 15%. Why? And that's what we were all raised with, right? Everyone's seeing their mom do it, and it's like, yeah, okay. If my dad's not doing it, it means it's effeminate, or it's feelings-based, or whatever. The church is not feelings-based. We'll talk about how next time. But you guys, I know it, because I've talked to a bunch of you, and I can see it, and you're here on a Saturday, and you care. You taught your sons the more important part. But I think when I talk to a lot of traditional leading men are just faithful men. Forget all the tribes or whatever. Unite the clans. Forget that. Who cares? Just faithful Catholic men. I don't care what mass you go to. As long as you go and you bring your sons and you tell them, as Michael Knowles said to me, I can't believe this is all real. As long as you tell them, look, this is all real. It's the one true faith. You're good there. But how many of you, I want to challenge you here today, because I'm going to forget to do it in my later talk. How many of you taught your sons to fight? Got to know how to fight in these days. I mean, you guys live in Portland, man. You can't even walk in some parts of your city. You never knuckle under to a bully. You got to fight. Going to be a Christian, got to learn to fight. So, I mean, I know it's a challenge, and I'll talk about more the basis, the justification for the challenge in my next talk. We're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about what the patriarchy is. The patriarchy strikes back. Sophia's worried to publish my book, right? Because a couple of my brother's tweets, he's saucy, he's salty on tweets, and because of what we want to subtitle it, and because the feminists are already getting riled up, probably 40% of them are here in your burg, Portland, these people. Wow. But seriously, teach your sons to fight. Teach your sons to pray. America needs it. And you don't care about America for its own sake, but believe it or not, what you needed to take out of this talk into my next talk, so I'm not doing a whole bunch of crossover like I've been doing in this first one, is the world needs America, and the world doesn't even matter for its own sake. It's part of providence. Unbelievably, when I was putting all this together the last 5 or 6 years of my life, what you see me talk about with Taylor Marshall on TNT, hopefully now with my brother David and my friend Chris on Rules for Retrogrades. Check us out if you haven't, by the way. Is, holy cow, this stuff isn't just practical. It's not just a pragmatic fit that America has in the world now. All this is happening by design. It was all foretold by Mary way before Fatima. You know, Quito, Ecuador in 1591, Our Lady of Good Success. After Fatima, Akita, Japan, 1973. America has a unique role to play in the way that the world is going to wind itself down before the parousia of Jesus. It's real. It's all real. So we'll talk about how real it can get when the patriarchy strikes back next. But yeah, you guys come say hi at my table, and I guess we'll take a little break. Sorry. I've wound down like three ways. I like to, like Michael Scott, I like to try a few beginnings and a few endings. So I did like three or four. We'll see you guys in a sec.